Okay, welcome, Chris. We're happy that you're here and finally arrived. My suggestion is that we go on with the discussion a bit later and let first Chris have his presentation. And I would like to introduce to you Chris Hoadley. Chris, we already did a kind of introductory round, so if we may skip that and you speak to, I mean, you know many of us and we just skip the introductory round, but I like to introduce you. You have a bachelor's degree from MIT, a master's degree from the University of California at Berkeley, and also a PhD from that university. Specialization in these programs were on education and on information technology and computer science. So you have the very broad perspective that are also characteristic for the learning science that we also found in your text. You had positions as assistant professor in Stanford and at Penn State University. And you're now an associate professor at NYU, and also the director of two degree programs related to the learning sciences. Chris is now a professor of educational communication and technology. For us, very important, he's the co-founder of ISLS. I will come to this a little bit later. His research focus is on designing and building educational technology systems for supporting the social capital and distributed intelligence. And he is among the ones coining the term design-based research methods and design-based research more than 10 years ago. Which was very, very influential in not only in North America but also in the rest of the world. He was also the first president of the International Society of the Learning Sciences and co-founder. When I joined the ISLS board a couple of years ago, he has the informal function also of the memory of this community and of this society. I'm very happy that we have him as the first speaker. He also won several awards. Among them are a Fulbright Scholarship. I think this is one award that Chris is especially proud of or fond of, South Asia Regional Research Scholarship of the Fulbright Program. Also, he received a Fine Outreach for Science Award. He authored and co-authored more than 100 peer-reviewed papers and presentations. And now we are eagerly looking forward to your speech, Chris.
I feel like I don't deserve to have an introduction because I'm late. But hopefully I can make up for it by trying to give a quick overview. And I know Frank had sent out three articles. And each of them, I think, covers a different part of what is a very interesting history in the learning sciences. But it's also, I think, you know, the most important thing is not the details of exactly what happened when, but maybe some of the story arcs of how we came to be where we are here. Can people hear me okay? I see my microphone is not quite reaching the highest. Yes, no problem, says Chris. Okay, good. So, you know, one thing I wanted to just sort of bring to people's attention is the idea that as a discipline, you know, we investigate two questions that are very central to the learning sciences, both of which are were in the past somewhat controversial or had to be discovered. And the one question is, how does learning happen? Are there scientific laws about how learning can happen, how it can be structured, how we can cause it to happen under given circumstances? And then a sort of flipped question is, what do we do about that knowledge? So not only is it enough to try to understand how learning is taking place, but also to think about how can we engineer learning? And these two halves, the sort of engineering side and the research side or the scientific side of the learning sciences, are really a big part of the history of how we came to be at this point. You know, I like to start when I talk to my students about the history of the learning sciences. I always start with the history of psychology, because again, it's really only a little over 100 years that we've had people believing that we could use empirical scientific style investigation to explore human thinking and human learning. And so when you look back at the history of psychology and how it came to be, you start uncovering figures who came from very different paradigms, and oftentimes had to reconcile those paradigms with other paradigms about how you uncover information about how people think. So of course, we know about Sigmund Freud, and he came from a medical perspective. His investigations were based in part on introspection and treating the human experience itself as data that could be uncovered through talk. We also have early developmental psychologists like Piaget. Jean Piaget, of course, was a Swiss scholar who came from biology, and in many cases he was using his training in biology and the forms of understanding, for instance, how a flower or a plant develops, to help him understand how his own children and their thinking was developing. And then, you know, scholars like Vygotsky, who came from literary theory and from semiotics, is what we would probably call it today, but trying to understand how meaning comes from the kinds of symbols and signals and words and utterances and actions that we deliver in the world, not merely as static, unchanging representations, but also as a ground for interactions between people. For instance, his zone of proximal development and looking at the interactions between a mother and a child, for instance. So, you know, when you look at each of those examples, you realize that these people came from very different places to start to ask these questions about, can we figure out how people think and learn, and what do we do about it? And really, the learning sciences comes out of, I think, a very interesting confluence of paradigms in the middle of the 20th century. There's a wonderful book by a historian named Ellen Lagerman, which she calls Education and Elusive Science. And she discusses how in the very earliest days of academic studies of education in the United States, there was a bit of a schism, a separation between one school that was dominated by Thorndike and Skinner, the behaviorist school that was really trying to use the mechanisms of experimental science to understand human learning. And then also John Dewey, and sort of more of a practice-based school that was maybe more contextualized, more applied, and less concerned with universal laws of education. And the way Ellen Lagerman characterizes that history is one of a sort of fight for legitimacy. So, you know, in the early half of the 20th century, you have these schools of education coming into being, and there were a lot of struggles over whether it was more legitimate to do a controlled psychology experiment, preferably in the behaviorist paradigm, where you only were concerned with observable externally, and a more introspection-friendly, practice-oriented, and contextualized type of inquiry that was exemplified by John Dewey's lab school at the University of Chicago. So you have these sort of two trajectories. But as I said in one of the articles that I shared about differences between the instructional design community and the learning sciences community, or rather the learning sciences and technology community in the United States, is that although people may be investigating similar questions, if they have different paradigms or if they participate in different communities, those things can move along in parallel without interacting very much. And so you know, what you see in the middle of the 20th century is, on the one hand, people who were very concerned with being rigorous in the psychological form, and people who were concerned about being very practical in schools and with teaching. And then round about the middle of the 20th century, and I should add, my knowledge of this portion of the story is very North American centric. I will freely admit I don't know the whole story, but I can tell you my perceptions of it from my perspective as an American. You start to have, especially in the United States, some mixing of disciplines in interesting places. So there's a great book by Howard Gardner called The Mind's New Science that talks about the history of cognitive science. And cognitive science was really revolutionary in the psychological sciences because it explicitly became a place where it was possible to use insights from multiple disciplines to try to understand human thinking. And so all of a sudden you have people, for instance, who have data from, let's say, neurological disorders or from medical studies, trying to reconcile what they're seeing with psychologists who were doing perhaps experimental psychology in a lab, and then also with perhaps linguists who were studying language practices and comparing languages around the world. And similarly, other disciplines participated as well in the cognitive science revolution in the United States, including anthropology, sociology, philosophy, and interestingly, computer science. So that's a topic that is very special to me. One of the early connectors between psychology and computer science was Herb Simon. He won a Nobel Prize in economics, but he reformed a lot of disciplines. And one of the things that he was concerned with was how to model cognition using these new electronic computers that were becoming available. So after doing a lot of studies of thinking and action, more or less from a behaviorist point of view, he became part of this revolution towards thinking of cognition less as a series of conditioned behaviors and more as a series of mental structures. And at that time, the computer itself was a very powerful metaphor for how thinking and learning might be taking place, that the manipulation of symbols could be seen as a way to represent how thinking took place. And there was a sort of golden age in the late 70s through the late 80s where artificial intelligence research and psychology research were able to help each other by using computer programs to model how people were thinking. And then also, as part of that history, using computer programs to help support different kinds of thinking and especially learning in the form of intelligent tutoring systems. John Anderson was also at Carnegie Mellon along with Herb Simon, and did a lot of work in human memory and learning, but also in how to support learning through artificial intelligence systems that modeled human thinking and then supported specific interventions based on those models of thinking. So, you know, you get up to the mid to late 80s, and there's this very interesting mix where cognitive science is creating a lot of space for people to use different kinds of disciplinary perspectives to investigate how people think, how people learn, and even to intervene in it. Now, one thing that's important to know about the U.S. version of the story from this point forward is a lot of it comes from our U.S. National Science Foundation. And so in the U.S., this National Science Foundation does have a mandate to study the social sciences, social, behavioral, and economic sciences, but that's a very small part of its mission. But it has a very large mission to support not only science and engineering research, but also science and engineering education and science and engineering education research. And so right around the 1980s in the U.S., you get a lot of either current or former scientists, current or former cognitive scientists, and technologists, all getting research money from the same funding organization and starting to talk to each other. And this is, I would say, one of the key factors in the birth of the learning sciences. Now, 1991 was both the year that the Journal of the Learning Sciences started and also the year I started graduate school. So this is my own participation in this history starts in the early 90s. In the early 90s, there was a conference series called AI in Education, Artificial Intelligence in Education. It was a pretty global conference, a lot of participation from both Europe and North America. A man named Roger Schenck, who is well known in the artificial intelligence literature, was going to host it at his home institution of Northwestern University in Chicago. And he chose single-handedly to rename this conference the International Conference of the Learning Sciences. Interestingly, he didn't talk to anybody else about this, and it caused in many ways a lot of bad feelings, I think, from people who felt like perhaps their conference had been stolen away from them and turned into something else. But I think justifiably so, he and others, including Janet Klodner, who was the founding editor of the Journal of the Learning Sciences and a student of Roger Schenck's, both felt that there was a need for blending this sort of science of learning grounded in these cognitive disciplines, not just psychology, but all of the cognitive science disciplines, and what you might call learning engineering, or being able to apply those ideas in creating learning environments. It wasn't a novel thing in the United States to have people worried about instructional design or about designing learning environments. But what was novel was there was a real sort of open-ended spirit connected to some really novel ideas about how thinking and learning took place that made it a little bit more of a broad-based endeavor in the United States. So where, let's say, a 1985 instructional design faculty member might be studying how to design instructional materials based on theories of learning that came primarily from psychology, you might also have a learning scientist, we'll call it that, at that time in the mid-80s or early 90s, starting to study how teaching and learning work and how to design learning environments with a much more broad-based theoretical perspective. And one example of how these two perspectives were different came up in 1993. There was a special issue of the journal Cognitive Science, and it focused primarily on the question of situated cognition. So there was this very strong concern that if we didn't have rigor, that we wouldn't know, we wouldn't be able to have reliable findings about thinking and learning, but how rigor came from disciplines like psychology that felt that it was very important to look at the mental representations and the mental machinery, the cognitive psychology of how people were thinking and learning. You also had a different group of people who were looking at rigor from a sociocultural, a linguistic, an anthropological point of view, and looking at how culture and context shape thinking and learning. 1991 was also the year that Levin Wenger started making a splash with their theories of communities of practice and situated cognition. Jim Greenough was at the time the editor of the journal Cognitive Science, a prominent learning scholar. And really, I mean, it's a bit of an overgeneralization, but I would say that that crisis within cognitive science about the connections between culture and thinking continued, but they were most felt in the education discipline, where those clashes may have mattered the most. Obviously, if you're trying to run a classroom, it's very important to know what the machinery, the mental machinery, the mind, the brain science of what's going on. But it's also really important to know what's the culture in that classroom, what's the social relationship between the teacher and the students and among the students. What are the cultural backgrounds that the students have in the rest of their lives outside that classroom, and so on. And in my mind, the 1990s are when the learning sciences, again, I'll use that name, although not everybody at that time would have, started to really break new ground by looking at how this interplay between the cognition in the old sense of kind of mental machinery and the cognition in the sense of situated cognition and culture would interface with each other. Now, I'm not as familiar with this history, but you know, there are some parallel debates that took place in the European scholarly community through the 20th century in this area as well. A third element that injects itself in the 1990s is this idea of design. And so how can we take our sciences that we develop to study learning, and how can we also apply them in this engineering sense towards design? So you really get this really interesting mix in the 1990s of people from a lot of different backgrounds, not just from psychology or education, studying problems of learning with different paradigms. You get them trying to make interventions and implement them in real contexts and coming up with all the complexity that that encounters. And you get a lot of people who are interested in science learning, technology learning, the applications of technology to learning in different disciplines. And around this time, I can say a little bit more about the history as it relates to the Learning Sciences Society. So again, as I said, I started graduate school in 1991. One of the earliest conferences I presented at was the first CSCL conference in 1995. And among other venues, there were these places where people would come together to talk about these issues of learning, technology, design, and interdisciplinary research in human thinking and development. And one of them was the nascent CSCL community. Another was the International Conference of the Learning Sciences itself, which continued on with a pretty different audience after 1991. The second conference was held in 1996, also at Northwestern. This time it brought in a lot fewer computer scientists and artificial intelligence researchers and a lot more people from education. Then you see these two conferences developing over time, and by the time I was getting involved in the formation of the Learning Sciences Society, it was very clear that there was a community developing around these three venues, the Journal of the Learning Sciences, the International Conference of the Learning Sciences, and the CSCL Conference. Now there were some politics at the time. The society was founded in 2002 after a three-year process with an international board of advisors trying to suggest how the organization should operate and what it should do. And by and large, this move was uncontroversial in the United States, in part because people perceived those three venues to be all the same community. But when CSCL happened in Bergen, Norway, in 2003, there was a lot of pushback about, wait a minute, is CSCL part of the learning sciences or not? And there were a lot of intense discussions, and I think people began to realize that there was a lot of affinity in terms of the research that was being done, but that the communities themselves weren't as overlapping as people might have thought. I and other people, Martin Vestner and Andrea Keenley, did some bibliometric analysis and really discovered that, for instance, the International Conference of the Learning Sciences was mostly a North American community, but that CSCL was a community that encompassed both North America and Europe at that time. And so when the society was founded, apart from these politics, there was a lot of interest in trying to figure out, well, who all can join our community and where are they? How will we let them know? How will we bring them in? And a lot of effort was put into society. That was also around the time that the scheduling of the conferences was brought into the society. And as many of you know, a lot of those conferences have now taken place not only outside of North America, but also outside of Europe in Asia or Australia. And there have been attempts to try to move the conference to other regions of the world as well. Where we find ourselves now in the 2010s, I would say through the 2000s was a blossoming within the learning sciences of interchange. And those interchanges sometimes were international and sometimes interdisciplinary. Frank Fisher was responsible for a series of workshops that the U.S. National Science Foundation and the German DFG sponsored to promote exchanges between North American and German learning scientists. And I was very surprised to discover during that time that, in many cases there were educational psychologists, teacher educators, and computer scientists in Germany who may not have met each other had it not been for exchanges through this learning sciences community that was becoming more international. And similarly, I think other countries have different histories about how there are different communities, different research communities, different disciplines that speak to each other sometimes, but may or may not really work on the same problems together and blend their methods. So you see in the 2000s, this community is starting to cement itself. It's growing in international visibility. And to a large extent, I would say what I believe are the two defining features of the learning sciences begin to become visible and entrenched. One of those two features is this idea that not only are the learning sciences a relatively interdisciplinary space in which methods from many disciplines can be used, but there's also a comfort or a willingness to blend or articulate both sociocultural and cognitive or psychological views of thinking and learning. So you start to see a commitment to trying to see where the intersections are between these, rather than just dividing up the territory and saying, you study this part and we'll study this part. The other defining feature, and I think this is really a wonderful development in the field, is that the learning sciences are a home for design-based research. And again, as Frank mentioned, that was a term, I wish I could say I invented the concept, I did not. Anne Brown, Alan Collins, and others came up with this idea of blending the act of designing and learning through design with empirical research, and they called it design experiments. But by the late 90s, it was becoming clear that that name was confusing to people, and so I proposed design-based research as an alternative. Many people use different terms now, including design studies or design research. The idea of commitment to engineering and commitment to testing our theories not only by collecting data in research studies, but also through intervention, through design, through an attempt to implement our ideas in practice. And I do believe that that's one of the reasons that the learning sciences in the United States, at least, often encompass some of the most prominent researchers in education, people who have been president of the International Society of Learning Sciences are long-term members of the community of learning scientists, and many of them have been elected president of our American Educational Research Association. For a point in time, the Journal of the Learning Sciences was the most cited journal in education, according to the ISI journal rankings. And I think the reason is that there's been a lot of intellectual productivity, and not just usefulness, but intellectual productivity from trying to test our ideas in practice. So when you imagine having a discipline that forces itself to test its ideas out on the ground, you're quickly oriented towards those things that are most important for practice, but you're also quickly oriented towards rich and useful theoretical notions. So I think now, as we start the 20-teens, we can draw on that history of a more internationalized community. We can draw on this multidisciplinary heritage. We can draw on our commitments to designing and and slowly, I believe, we're starting to integrate more fully the disciplines that all of us come from, whether it's, someone who has a background in cultural historical activity theory, or someone who has a background in semiotics, someone who has a background in sociolinguistics, someone who has a background in computer science or interface design. I think all of these disciplines are really starting to work on some of the same problems, coming together to use some of the same language, and really beginning to make progress much more rapidly than we ever have before. So those are some thoughts about the history. I do hope people realize there are many stories in history. This is his story, my story, but again, there are portions of this that I've left out either because I didn't know them or because they weren't central in my experiences. But obviously, this history has versions that took place around the world, and I hope that's enough of me talking, and hopefully we can get back to having good discussion.
Thanks a lot, Chris, for this excellent short history of the learning sciences. Well, the plan is to have a short interview now, but maybe we can also split the interview questions and have an open discussion with everyone after the question. So is there any immediate question for clarification now? Else I would start with some of the more the of my interview questions. So as long as I don't see anyone right now, I would really like to start with the question that we already discussed while you were in the metropolitan still. So do you think, is the learning sciences a discipline or a developing discipline, an emerging discipline? Or is it neither of both, but rather a collection of sciences of learning, so addressing the same phenomenon, but from quite different perspectives and also with quite different disciplinary foundations and methods and concepts?
That's a good question, and I think the answer from my perspective depends on what you call a discipline. So, you know, if you read some of the philosophers of science, there's this idea of paradigms, which may take place within disciplines, with a basic concept that if you have a bunch of people working on a set of problems in a community, over time they will develop not only shared ideas about what are the understood theories, but also shared ideas about how to do research and what are the appropriate methods, and even what counts as a claim within that field. And I do believe that we are not yet in the learning sciences at a point where we all agree on what's a method, or even in some cases, what's a claim, especially in the area of design. Knowing what design knowledge is a very interesting question, and I don't think everyone in the learning sciences agrees on that. But on the other hand, I do think we are a discipline in the sense that it's a label that people are starting to apply to themselves. It's a community of people who do work together on similar questions, if not the same questions. And in many ways, just as cognition became both a subdiscipline of psychology in the form of cognitive psychology and a meta-discipline in the form of cognitive science, I would say that the learning sciences are starting to do a similar thing. In some ways, it's a sub-discipline of education research, and in other ways, it's a meta-discipline that crosses education research with many other disciplines. And as long as the community is good, I think it doesn't matter. You know, there are many, many people who are very concerned about having scholarship put into carefully defined categories. And I find that only useful to a point. I think if you go to conferences where people appreciate your work and understand it, where you can learn things that help you in your work, and where you can support each other in helping advance the field through research, then I don't think it matters if we all exist in departments that have the same name. Now, it may cause problems organizationally or institutionally. It certainly causes problems in terms of funding. But I still think the intellectual payoff is good enough that we should perhaps be asking the question of what does calling it a discipline do for us, and what does calling it a group of disciplines do for us?
Well, thanks, Chris. So any reactions at that point? So we had in the discussion before, we had the University of Washington, Phil, and others, and also Chris speaking to that point. Maybe you want to put that also into that part of the discussion or others?
So hi, thanks, Frank. This is Phil Bell. So one follow-on thought that kind of has been playing out over the last decade or so that relates to Chris's point about learning sciences as meta-discipline is here in the U.S., the National Science Foundation has infused a large chunk of funding into the sciences of learning, the six centers that have been funded over the last decade. And it's certainly only a small subset of the six centers, one or two, right? We think our center is a learning sciences center, and maybe the Pittsburgh Center too, you know, views themselves in that way. But otherwise, you know, the sciences of learning also pull into kind of a broader set of academic communities and other kind of epistemic communities that do work. So the one that is maybe finding its way onto the learning sciences horizon is kind of the neurosciences community. If you think of like Dan Schwartz and colleagues that are kind of being that bridge between neuroscientific work and kind of the more traditional engineering of learning work within learning sciences. And I know that's happening internationally as well. I don't know the players in other parts of the world, but that's one, I think, trend that's unfolding over the last decade, kind of another layer of the meta-disciplinary shift.
Maybe Chris wants to respond to that before I ask a follow-up question.
Maybe Chris wants to respond to it before you ask a follow-up question. I'm happy for this to be a roundtable discussion. It doesn't have to go through.
Okay, well, I think what I'll do is add my question to the mix, and then we'll see how we can respond. I think it has it resonates with the discussion at any rate. So Chris, you've said that the learning sciences have originated within different scientific communities, and you've pointed out that epistemologies that the researchers hold, the fundamental assumptions that they have about the world and doing research, can at times be a source of tension. Now, tension can be negative, but it can also be productive. And so it can be a productive in the way that if you have to compare tension, or if you have to compare frameworks, then you're forced to examine the assumptions that underlie them. And you can look at what it is that is really driving your research. And so you've spoken about how the fact that learning sciences is kind of open towards blending these different perspectives, like say the cognitive versus the sociocultural approaches to learning. And so I was wondering, for the students listening, is there a way to make this a bit more concrete for them? Do you have a kind of a personal narrative that you could share with us in order to show us how, in your experience, you came across different traditions, presumably like you were in one of them, and how they came together, either in compromised or either saw how their differences could rise productively to make a contribution. So it's in a sense, I'm asking to instantiate your discourse in a concrete example. I'm not sure if that's too hard to do because it might need too much background, but I'm betting that you could give us something.
Oh, well, thanks very much, Chris. I'll just discuss it with my colleague here, Rafa. If for the sake of the argument, we were to assume for a second that the learning science is a discipline, what would be some of the paradigms, some of the key paradigms that we could isolate out of this discipline, in your opinion? Thank you.
Okay, I'll try and respond to both of those at the same time. I mean, one of the stories I can tell. I was very fortunate because I had a lot of interdisciplinary exposure throughout my career. So as an undergraduate, I was a cognitive science major in a pretty interdisciplinary program at MIT, in which I took classes in computer science, in philosophy of mind, in psychology, including neuroscience and cognitive psychology. I also took courses in linguistics. I think initially I had this experience where, as an undergraduate, I had an advisor who's a developmental psychologist, Susan Carey, who was very interested in questions of conceptual change from the point of view of a psychologist. And I was also fortunate enough to work at the MIT Media Lab as a student intern. And both sets of mentors really didn't value each other's work very much. So, you know, Susan Carey thought the Media Lab was a place where people simply did what they liked and had no scientific rigor because they weren't properly contributing to a body of theory in the psychological discipline. And at the Media Lab, people felt like, you know, these psychologists were all talk and no action, that their findings were often somewhat useless, and that the real way to explore what was possible was by, as Alan Kay said, inventing the future. And so the tension between those two was palpable because I literally had mentors telling me to stop wasting my time with other mentors. But then I wound up at Berkeley in a really interdisciplinary research group. Marsha Lin was the head of that group, and she had funding to do research that might be seen as rather straightforward educational technology research, but it was very much steeped in this idea of both building and studying at the same time. And in particular, the work I did back then started out in a very strong dynamic of feeling like cognitive psychology was rigorous and useful and culture was not. An interesting side note, Phil Bell was there for some of this, but I started graduate school the same year as Reed Stevens, and he was very much coming from the cultural point of view, and so we would have these fights our first year of graduate school about who had more rigor. And at the time, I started working with discussion tools, very early multimedia threaded discussion tools. And, you know, trying to study the psychological in a collaborative learning setting, in a CSCL setting, without taking into account some of the cultural, simply wasn't practical. And so because I and other colleagues, including Sherry Shi, we're doing a lot of implementation of our software and our curriculum, we came to understand that we had to both solve the cognitive problems and the sociocultural problems. And I think that was a good example of me having to skill up very quickly. And I quickly learned how important it was to understand these methods for studying and understanding culture. And to use them, at least learn them well enough to use them in my own work. More recently, and I think this gets to the Nottingham question, you know, I find that the way disciplines get labeled does sometimes limit you or support you. A lot of my work in the last 10 years has been on using CSCL, especially low-tech CSCL, in developing countries. I've done a lot of work in India and Nepal, some work in Bhutan, in Ghana, and oftentimes there, the design problems, again, force you to immediately come up against paradigms that conflict with each other. So the paradigm of international development versus the paradigm of participatory design, in many cases, the paradigms we know from the learning sciences in education maybe less relevant in places where, for instance, you know, the perception is really the information delivery mechanisms rather than teaching and learning institutions. And that's not necessarily because nobody got the message about learning theory. It may also be because in areas of extreme need, there may not be infrastructure capable of providing environments for teaching and learning, and so the best you can hope for is information delivery. And so, you know, sometimes you'll propose some kind of project. I must have written a grant proposal 5 different ways to say, I'd like to do research in rural Himalayan villages in which technology is used both for building cultural capital and for school learning on the topic of environmental science. And then somebody will come back to me and say, wait, is this research or outreach? Is this an aid project or a research project? And even if they treat it as a research project, they say, well, is this research on development or on learning, education? And sometimes those pigeonholes can cost you the grant. You know, it's been very difficult to get that kind of work funded for me because of these paradigms, these disciplines that are perceived to be separate from each other. And you know, as Chris said, sometimes the questions that are raised by these tensions are exactly the right questions. They're hard questions, but they're very productive ones. For instance, can we reasonably talk about education outcomes in a developing country without considering livelihood and economic outcomes? Can we talk about cognition in a particular domain, such as systems thinking about ecological processes, without also thinking about cultural and ecological context of those cognitions, and so on? I mean, I think you know, the particulars of my story may be just one set of particulars, but I suspect all of the more senior researchers on this call have had their own examples of these kinds of stories.
Okay, are there other comments or questions on this aspect? Yeah, University of Washington again.
So just to kind of add a bit of a backfill around the last 5 years, building directly off of Chris's comments there around kind of people who have been approaching cognition and cultural context oriented to ecological dimensions of learning. I would say, you know, Carol Lee's educational researcher piece in 2008 talking about the centrality of culture in a science of development, which makes kind of a very tight argument for that work, highlights the intellectual apartheid between kind of scholarship on learning and the sciences of learning and a kind of equity-focused scholarship in education. So I think what she hints at that point is that it seems like the learning sciences field is starting to shift to take up kind of theories and methods and stances that would kind of foreground kind of equity dimensions in learning in a way that were both, you know, beneficial in an applied sense, but also were directly scientific as well. So now, I think that's been unfolding. You can see hints of it in situated learning with, you know, in 1991 with Levin Wenger, and certainly people, Beth Warren and Roseberry and others have been doing this good work for a long time. But I think we do have a bit of a groundswell, to the point where our funders, the National Science Foundation, now talks about funding the science of broadening participation as a line of work in their solicitation. So I think we have that recent development in the last 5-10 years that's also kind of expanding.
One question I have for everyone is, assuming, I see Mike has his hand up. I mean, one question I have for everyone is, to what extent has your own experience of this community, of this learning sciences community, surprised you? I do think one of the challenges moving forward, you know, part of it is making sure that we connect the dots within our own community and that we get different paradigms and different perspectives talking to each other. And another, and I think this is a, you know, this particular effort of Naples is a very good step in the right direction. One big issue for the learning sciences is how do you tell someone what the learning sciences are in less than an hour-long flash meaning? Is there a way to say, okay, the learning sciences is this? And I think especially for people here on this call who are new to the learning sciences, some of the things that surprised them about this community or the research that they're reading would be really interesting to hear. Sort of what are the aspects of this community that aren't obvious from the outside?
Oh yeah.
Hi, we're live in Toronto. You realize you lose the last second of your speech somehow to this technology, right? This is Jim Slotta and my four of the students here in my group. Thanks, Chris. It's been really interesting. And I think building on your point, my question has to do with, I guess you'd say, boundedness. As you say, you know, when you try to tell someone about learning sciences, when you try to conceptualize yourself as a practitioner in learning sciences, when your students are trying to get their head around becoming a learning scientist, there's so many open dimensions of that. And for example, multidisciplinarity runs a risk. I mean, there are so many disciplines that you can tie in. Lately, we've been tying into organizational behavior. We've been tying into, you know, facilitation methodologies, but, you know, not human-computer interaction. So, you know, it's a sort of pulling threads out of a fabric if you keep tossing disciplines in. Same with cultural complexity. You know, it's true that we have to get deep into a problem and that everything that we build is so situated in that problem and needs to be understood in terms of that, so there's that super depth aspect and that super breadth aspect. And I guess the question there for me is, you know, maybe it's a boundary question. If it is a science, really, and I notice it's always the plural, right? If there's multiple of them, where are they? If there's one, you know, what are the canons of the science and how do we keep track of them? So how does somebody go look and find out what the science knows? If it's a design science, that's okay. But how are we as a community supposed to, you know, kind of track our progress, refer to it, and then kind of define ourselves in something that's not a sort of too loose, too broad, and too everything. Over.
I like this idea of saying over as a way to make sure that it doesn't cut off. You know, I personally think, and I there are many people on this call who I think are at least as qualified as me to debate what might be possible. But I would like to say that I hope that it's both bounded and connected. And I take some inspiration from the cognitive science community because, again, there are venues within the cognitive science community that are explicitly multidisciplinary. There are scholars who make that space their primary home, but there are plenty of other scholars who come and go back to their home disciplines. You know, so the neuroscientist who publishes in neuroscience journals but has done a collaborative project with a linguist and then brings that to this cross-disciplinary venue of the cognitive science community. And then, you know, maybe bring some things back to where they are in their more bounded discipline. I mean, one thing that has kind of surprised me, and maybe I shouldn't be surprised by this, is how the learning sciences conferences have not fragmented as a community. Really, I mean, it's grown, and there was a lot of meshing of groups that didn't know each other in the late 90s, early 2000s. But since, I'd say, around 2004, I really feel like there's been a constant pattern of core members of the community publishing in these learning sciences venues in IJC, SEL, and JLS, going to the learning sciences conferences, and then a pretty good, I'd say, third rule, where you have a third who are sort of core community members, a third who are perhaps not core intellectually, but are geographically connected. So, you know, when the conference is in Australia, you end up with a lot more Australians at the conference. And then the other third is people who are sort of coming and going, people who have something that they wanted to bring to a venue that was friendly to the type of work it was, or who want to learn something and bring it back to their home disciplines, their home conferences, their home journals. And so I think we can do both. You would worry if the core community grew so large that it was no longer a community. But that hasn't really happened. That there feels like there's both continuity and permeability, and that I think is really great.
Hi. So that I'm not sure this is really doing it for me. First of all, I don't know how much faith I have that cognitive science is on super strong footing as a persistent discipline. Second, because you're kind of suggesting that we have these sort of true disciplines, and then that sort of cross, you know, that intersection, that learning sciences would be that intersection. So Franck would hang on to psychology, right? And some of us would stay in education, and at learning sciences is going to be this thing that is a common watering hole that we go to. If that's true, then I guess the question is that what you're saying, that it's going to be essentially always this intersection of true disciplines, and that it will be a kind of a social network and a place for us to do multidisciplinary work. Over.
So if I had to, this is a guess, and it's a bit unfair because I was never a core member of the cognitive science community, but if I had to guess why the cognitive science community has lost steam, it is precisely because they stopped being as interdisciplinary as they once were. Again, as evidenced by this confusion over situated cognition, and at some level there was an attempt to kind of divide and conquer, and maybe have people specialize in subdomains that didn't continue speaking to each other. So, you know, I would agree that the cognitive science community isn't as vibrant as it once was, but that's also, I think, in part because they didn't stick to what they were good at. But at another level, there's also this interesting phenomenon. Again, if you look at cognitive psychology, you know, you've got to remember cognition was a fringe idea in psychology when in the 70s, people were starting to argue against behaviorism forcefully with data from other disciplines, especially language, and both language pathologies and linguistics, the study of linguistics. You know, Noam Chomsky's work really, it caused a shaking of the bedrock of the foundations of psychology at the time. And nowadays, cognition is, if not encompassing all of psychology, it's at least a dominant paradigm within psychology, maybe coexisting with you know, more cultural psychology or clinical psychology or other subdomains. But it's pretty rare to find a psych department that wouldn't have cognition as its core subspecialty. And, you know, there's a similar question, I think, for the learning sciences is, will it replace the field of education, the academic study of education? And in some ways, that's a more complicated question than the question of whether cognitive science was going to replace the field of psychology, because what the academic study of education is so different in different places. Again, there's this, more like medicine, there's this much larger demand to create practitioners. You know, in psychology, yes, you may need to create clinical psychologists, but it's not the main thing that most psychology departments do. And similarly, I think, you know, in education in different countries, the way that the labor force of schooling is created is really different. And whether that's part of academic research or not, you know, as I understand it, in Germany, the teacher colleges are not necessarily super well tied to psychologists who happen to study learning. You know, in the United States, we tend to have educational psychology programs inside of schools of education, so on and so forth. So, you know, whether the learning sciences becomes education or replaces the discipline of education is a really complex part of that story about whether we are a discipline or not. And, you know, you could ask the same question, is education a discipline? And the answer probably even depends on where you ask it.
Thanks, everyone, for this excellent discussion of the disciplinary or the discipline question and discipline issues and development. I like the question that Chris posed in some intermediate phases, where I think he asked, especially the students, what really surprised you when you became aware of the learning sciences or became more acquainted with work in the learning sciences. So what were the big surprises? I would have a couple of, but I'm not a student right now. So if students could participate and sharing their surprises within the learning sciences.
And if that question is too hard, I would also even throw in things that have confused you about what are the learning sciences.
Hi, Diana Sippy at the University of Washington. We have pretty regular site visits from NSF folks, and one of the things that's surprising to me is how surprised they are about interdisciplinarity or multidisciplinarity still, even though there seems to be the movement towards thinking about the preparation that we're getting as students to set us up to do this multidisciplinary work, but that as the funders, they seem so confused as to what it is we're doing and how we all seem to be in the education department and where we all are coming from. So that's been surprising to me.
Maybe Naples needs to run a course for program officers at funding organizations.
So maybe I share one of my surprises and one of my confusions in earlier times, but also I have a couple of confusions or point of confusions left with respect to the harsh criticism of many learning scientists with respect to experimental research and the very strong focus on design-based research. Although I think it's really important and really innovative work, but there are areas in the world where design-based research is not very prominent, and people still feel as being scientists. For example, I think in Germany there are not many people doing design-based research in a systematic way. They have different other types of methods, but they still do what they think and what I think is learning sciences research. If you look into especially computer-supported collaborative learning, there's a lot of experimental work. There's also a lot of other methodological orientation outside of design-based research. And I think my surprise is that if you have a learning scientist, a prominent learning scientist, and you force him or her to answer the question, so what is really specific about learning sciences, then a typical answer is, so there is the authentic context and there is design-based research. And in earlier times, there was also this focus on science education that confused Europeans a little bit. I think that had to do with the funding policy in the US, but we were wondering, well, we have history education, we have language education, we have medical education, but there's so much focus on science education, which is interesting, of course, but is that systematic? Has that to do with the nature of the learning sciences, or is that more or less, has developed through the constraints of the funding policy at that time?
It's easy to answer the second question, which is yes, in the US, a lot of this had to do with accidents about how the US government funds research. And also You know, not only is there a lot of funding in the National Science Foundation, which can focus on science education as opposed to other disciplines, such as language education or social studies education or music education. But I also think there were political histories in the United States that made it more risky to do any research related to politically sensitive areas of education, and especially things like history and social studies were very politically sensitive in terms of what the government and politicians felt should be allowed to be part of student education, and therefore there really wasn't space to be empirical about it in that way. But having said that, I think that's changing, partly because, again, you can't really look at a theory of learning and only study physics learning and then expect it to apply to another domain like language acquisition or, again, you know, arts education or whatever else. And I do think that, I mean, I personally have been very negative in public sometimes towards experimental research, only in as much as I believe that it misused. I think there are a lot of policymakers who want simple answers, and I think there are a lot of experimentalists who believe that anything that isn't an experiment is useless. And I think the question of whether a particular method is useful depends entirely on the question and how the study is conducted. And so, you know, there are certain things, especially if you're looking at universals of human psychology that apply in many, many contexts, that are a lot easier to study in a laboratory experimentation paradigm. And similarly, there are a lot of questions related to human culture that are a lot easier to study in an anthropological or sociological paradigm with qualitative methods and non-experimental research. And, you know, I don't think either of those is a bad idea in general. I just don't think either one of them is going to solve all of our problems. And so design-based research is not, I would never advocate that it be a replacement for all other paradigms within our field. But I do think it's a framing that allows us to keep ourselves accountable to making something happen in practice, to being useful. And it also should always be a viable alternative for things that are very context sensitive or places where an experiment or an ethnography might not answer our questions. So, you know, it's funny because I don't know if anybody else has had this experience, but I have certainly encountered a number of graduate students who have told me, I want to do a qualitative dissertation, without saying anything about what kind of questions they want to investigate. And I always tell them, you're not allowed to say that until you know what you want to investigate. I mean, sure, maybe you have a preference for certain kinds of research methods, but the methods have to follow the questions. And I guess one thing that's encouraging about the learning sciences is people are willing to use eclectic methods or combinations of methods to try to answer questions. And then it's okay to use, for instance, ethnographic data to critique an experimental finding or vice versa.
Okay, thank you. There are no immediate comments on that. So my other question that I had in mind is at the current conferences of the learning sciences and CCL, there is a discussion with respect to the role of computer sciences in the learning sciences and in CSCL, and some say it is about the marginal role of the computer sciences in the learning sciences. And I thought we asked Chris, because he's also a computer scientist, on his perspective on that, but maybe also the others. What do you think is the role of computer science in the learning sciences?
So I'll make an observation based, again, in history. Both the first International Conference of the Learning Sciences and the first CSEL conference in 1995, not taking into account the workshops that took place before that, Both of them were nominally computer science conferences. So ICLS was, as I said, an artificial intelligence and education conference. And CSCL in 1995 in Bloomington, Indiana, was actually an ACM-sponsored conference. And it was intended to mirror the CSCW conference. And I think one thing that has been sort of a challenge in keeping computer science alive in the learning sciences is that while, for instance, a sociologist may be able to read a psychology paper and appreciate what kind of contribution it makes and where it's coming from, it's sometimes harder for, say, an education researcher to read a computer science paper that's very technical and to really appreciate what the contribution is there. There's also, within computer science, I think a lot of schisms between the human-computer interaction and interface portions of the discipline and the rest of the discipline. So, you know, computer science departments tend to wall off their HCI faculty and students, and oftentimes they are, you know, expected to be really different in terms of their training and their paradigms and what counts as contribution to the field and so on. And so I think both of those factors make it difficult for computer science to be a core and visible part of the Learning Sciences Conference at the current moment. But I do hope that changes, especially as you know, there are a lot of people in the interface world who are, I think, somewhat dissatisfied with the dominant paradigms there. Oftentimes, if you go to the ACM Chi conference, you will find papers that rely on 30-year-old social science or very simplistic social science methodologies that seem rigorous to a casual you know, eye, but that don't have the depth that really helps people understand maybe the phenomena that they're looking at. And a good example of a place where the social science gets more rigorous is the CSCW conferences, in part because if you want to understand group work, you really need to start thinking about social science in a more complex way. And I hope that our community will become so useful and attractive to that world that we'll start drawing them into our spaces. But until we do, I think it's important to just remember to make space for the paradigms of computer science within our conferences, just as Kai tries to make space for the social sciences within the computer science discipline. You know, for instance, how likely is it that a paper gets accepted to a conference or journal that solves some really interesting technical problem that is very relevant to learning today? And, you know, if we don't accept those kinds of papers, then the computer scientists won't come to our conferences and we won't be able to learn from them. I also think, and this is very much like the Herb Simon story, I think we are seeing a resurgence of computer scientists interested in modeling the phenomena of education, and especially in the educational data mining and learning analytics space. We're getting to the point now where people with really interesting algorithms and modeling backgrounds from computer sciences can be really useful in the social sciences and in education in particular. So we may see that connection rebuilding not only through the HCI vector, but also through connections to new and interesting kinds of data and modeling about learning.
He didn't do it. I wanted to just, maybe it's Mike, University of Toronto, push on that again and maybe build on something that Jim said. And I think it's good that we have a lot of people coming in from different fields like CS, and, you know, some, like Jim said, some of our stuff is getting into HCI. But I wonder if there's a little bit of a concern that we get too excited about what's cool and new, and we start running down pathways that pull us away from what should really be important, I think, in what we do, which is the learning. So I know that there's been a lot of talk about how we integrate HCI, especially in some of the more complex designs and stuff that we do. But I guess my worry is that, you know, if we start doing too much of that, I think we need to draw from it, but there needs to be a balance. And I'm wondering maybe other people's thoughts on this, like we could start really getting into what it means for a kid to touch a button like on a spot on a screen and the HCI affordances of that. But then we spend months just designing a well-designed screen and the learning becomes secondary to all the kind of cool things that we can do with the technology. Over.
Yeah, I'm curious what other people have to say about that, because I think you're right, and I think it's a challenge even in the HCI field. I've been on the program committee for the CHI conference, and oftentimes there's a real struggle with how to judge whether design-oriented or as they call it, systems papers are judged to be real contributions or not. Is it enough to say, I built this cool thing? When does the design really advance the field, and how do you maintain any form of cumulativity when you're talking about a more engineering-oriented discipline, especially one that doesn't have very well-defined aims? And so I think that idea of, being mindful of both the benefits and dangers of including, hey, I built this cool thing in your academic discipline or conferences or community.
Okay, so maybe we have to postpone that part of the discussion also to one of the next sessions, maybe a face-to-face session. We were talking with Chris about a panel discussion during one of our next conferences, which would be great on some of these topics. I think we have to close this meeting at a certain point, but I would be really interested in having some kind of final words of the different groups. So maybe if you can just say bye bye or whatever, or I would also be very much interested, and also I think Dan Hickey is, about what we can improve about these webinars more didactically, if you wish. You can also send that by mail, I guess. But first, let me thank Chris a lot for this great presentation, for this great discussion. I think we touched on very, very important aspects in the context of the learning sciences, and we learned a lot. Let me also say that this is maybe not a typical webinar in this learning sciences series, because it's more meta webinar. It's not about a specific learning sciences topic, but it's more about the discipline or the group of disciplines working together and the history. So there will be a lot more, let's say, empirical research presented and work being discussed in later sessions. But maybe we make the quick round to say bye-bye and maybe have a couple of final words.
Oh, we're on. I have one suggestion. We were talking about it for these webinars, and I think that these flash meetings have 30 spots. And I know we're trying to keep the people who are going within our group, but it might be good if I know there were a couple people who couldn't make it into the school today to be in this little room. If like the institutions had a couple, like, I don't know what we'd call them, but like beta invites. And so like every university kind of has an alpha. And so if we all get in the room, we can do that. But we have betas. And so it would be great to be able to fill up the spots, because, you know, at the end of this meeting, we have, 6 to 8 group like labs checking in. But, you know, if we really were able to get like 20 people in, I think, you know, the whole thing becomes more vibrant. We have more opportunities for discussion, more points of view. And it's hard to coordinate everyone to get into a room. So I don't know whether we could open up to the institutions, just like the people who are part of Naples, but instead of having one login, if we had 2 or 3, and if it fills up, if you're on one of the beta ones, okay, you understand that going in, that every university has to get in once, And so there's the alpha, and if you're on a beta, you might get bumped. But it would make it for people who wanted to come in and couldn't, to make it available for them. That's just as a thought to allow more people to be in on these.
Hi, everyone. I just wanted to thank Chris for the talk and appreciate the Herculean effort to get on a network. Thanks, Chris. And to Frank and the other organizers of Naples, this is a really good idea, and I'm looking forward to the whole year. The community here is really excited, and I think it's going to be really productive to help coordinate and expand people's understanding of our field. We have a tradition here of having a back channel going, so we can kind of chat around the formal public presentation. So I think that's something we might think about. It's just a good additional layer to let students kind of find their way through a conversation and kind of you know, make sense of it. So take care, everyone.
I just also I noticed that a lot of us are looking very dark on the screens. Just a matter of protocol. There must be a way to get some more light on our faces if we're sitting. I mean, Chris looks like he's in a witness protection program. Frank, you could see a little bit better, but lightening up.
Ah. There
we go. Lightening up our faces. One thing. I totally agree about the back channel. We've also been talking and texting throughout. My biggest worry. Frank, going forward is the number of these things. And for example, our group was really excited to be here for the inaugural one. And I agree it was neat to have Chris's, you know, take the lead on reviewing, you know, what the learning sciences are. But looking through the topics and just the great, you know, representation you have from, you know, from the field, they're all going to be really good. And I'm worried about how to keep people engaged when we're all busy and, you know, the students are all, a lot of them are in courses and there's time zone issues. And, you know, this kind of collective viewing is good. I don't see our group doing this, you know, 56 times in the next 6 months or whatever it is, several times a week sometimes. So that asks for, you know, that asks for, first of all, a much broader net to be cast. So we really do try to pull more people in. And then also an asynchronous modality where either, you know, either the video, the first video at least is captured and put online and people can interact around that, or it's streamed somewhere on the side. So maybe we can't all be in the voice, you know, this nice little meetup system, but we could have a stream of the video that's forwarded through another channel so people can just log on and have it. So we ultimately, around the table, we're here because we couldn't all get individual sessions, right? But there must be some way to think forward how to make this more accessible to the broad catchment of people in all of our Naples institutions. Over.
Hi, everybody. We would just like to thank you, Chris, for presenting today and for Frank holding this conversation. And since there's two of us are first-year learning science students, so I think it's a great chance to kind of like to start and to try to know what is really learning sciences. Yeah, thanks.
Okay, just as a quick response, I think my personal view on how this will develop with the 50 webinars is that we might not see the whole groups every time again, but we have 23 universities with nearly 40 degree programs with more than 700 students enrolled, and my estimate is that we will have enough participation from the different universities. This time we only had 1 week preparation time, and I think you all did a great job, Chris, and also the different programs, universities, to arrange all this. But I think we will have a bit more time now to plan for the next sessions. The idea is, by the way, to have, if we have open seats available, then we open that up to the whole ICLS membership. That would be the idea. And we had a lot of requests, by the way, of other people, other presenters in that series who want to participate in the presentations of other learning scientists. And so far we said, well, we have to wait and see how this works out. If the programs all book their seats on a regular basis, then it's maybe possible for 5 or 10, but not for the 50 of them. So I'm not afraid of having too little participation. I think having 7 groups in the first, or 9 groups in the beginning, in this very first session, also groups from Asia, from Singapore, where it's in the middle of the night, I think that was very good already. So I don't have any concerns about that so far. So, Chris, would you like to say something at the very end? Chris Lund, and then Chris Hoadley in that.
Oops, okay. Yeah, I guess I'm the only one that hasn't yet thanked Chris, so thank you very much. I really enjoyed it, and also Frank and the rest of the gang at LMU. I think it's really going to be a great series, and I'm just really looking forward to it.
And I have to once again apologize for my technology issues. It's sort of poetic justice, I guess. But I will say, vielen Dank, Shishe. Merci bien. I am so flattered that everybody was willing to come together to discuss these issues and to hear a few things from me. And I will say I hope people continue the discussion at the conferences and in other places. This effort that Frank is leading is really an opportunity I wish I had 20 years ago. And I hope everybody who's involved realizes what a big deal this is and how special it is, both intellectually and in terms of understanding and getting support for work that doesn't always fit into a neat little box. This is a really important program of talks, and I'm so grateful to Frank and all of the Naples people for organizing it and putting this together, even though it involves so many speakers and time zones and technologies and coordination issues. So thank you, Frank. And as one last example of how these interdisciplinary works can lead to interesting places, I know some of the people on this call have gotten information about it, but I'm going to just put a URL into the chat. The reason that I had to travel so far to get to the office this morning is because we've just moved into a new facility. So our university has decided to found an interdisciplinary facility with graduate programs from the School of the Arts, from the School of Education, from the Computer Science Department, and from the School of Engineering, and they call it MAGNET, Media and Games Network. And I think we're already starting to see really, really interesting crosstalk, intellectual crosstalk between these different disciplines. And I hope that that becomes more normal as time goes on. And I'll also just say a warm invitation, if anybody finds themselves passing through New York City, you should absolutely come to Brooklyn and see this facility and see some of the interesting people here, because I think talking to people who are different from ourselves is the only way we're going to make any progress. And I'm very grateful that this venue here in the Learning Sciences Society exists as a place to do that.
Okay, thanks everyone. Thanks Chris for the invitation and the suggestions. Great discussion. Thank you everyone. Thanks for the suggestions in the end. I think we will try to implement as much as possible, and see you maybe next week. Bye-bye.